thrilled to see all of you here today, because probably more so because this particular talk in Writing Life series, the Market for Literary Magazines, was actually suggested by one of our member writers. And that is exactly the idea we had when we started thinking about hosting a series of talks by and for writers, and, you know, discussing topics of interest to our library's writing community. So I'm really excited about that. I hope to be able to continue this also into the fall. So if you have any ideas, anything of interest, please let me know. And I want to thank Lori Lyle for today's suggestion, because I think it's going to be a really great talk. Just a few things. There are some items of interest in the back, so before you leave, just take a look at those. There's some information from Karen on her periodically speaking series, which we'll talk a little bit more about. And there's also a handout which has the literary magazines and the Lit Press resources that we have here at the library. And there's also a paper on registering and posting to our New York Society Library Electronic Writers Forum. I know some of you are reading it. Sarah's smiling. Some of you are reading it. Some of you have registered. But I would really like more people to participate. So far, it's kind of been me and the spammers posting. And you know, while it's been, you know, exciting to have our first sort of off-color post a couple of weeks ago, I'd actually really prefer to hear from you guys. So if you just take a look at it and give me your feedback, you know, we're not committed to it. If it doesn't seem like the right thing for us, then, you know, we won't use it. But I'd like to give it a go first and give it some, and at least get some decent feedback from everyone. So help me out. Try to, you know, take a look at it. It does. All the information on how to register and how to post is on there. And if you have any questions, you can either talk to me or to Ingrid Rector, the head of systems. So either one of us can help. I'm really thrilled to have this great, great panel today. I was really excited. This is one of the ones that I'm really, really excited about. And a lot of that goes, that credit goes to Karen Gisoni, because Karen is the Helen B. Bernstein Librarian for Periodicals and Journals at the New York Public Library's Humanities and Social Sciences Branch. That is a really long title. But Karen is really the one that introduced me to this incredible array of literary magazines. And I interned for her when I was a library student, and it made a big impact on me. I have to say, it was one of the best experiences of my schooling. And she, no, really, it's true. She's a tireless promoter of literary magazines. And as a librarian at the New York Public Library, she's really amassed an incredible collection of literary magazines there. And she's focused now, she just told me, pretty much solely on collection, which is really tremendous, because I think, what do you have, more, something like 640 or 50
that's
literary magazines?
That's about right.
It's and in many languages from many countries. It's really an extraordinary collection. So I urge you to check it out if you have some time. Go down there and take a look at some of these magazines, because they're really extraordinary. She is also the host of a reading series at the library called Periodically Speaking, which features literary magazine editors introducing emerging writers, and that's a really terrific program as well. I think the first one of the season is April 14th. It's in the evening, and you should go. It's I think there's some information on the back on the dates coming up as well. And you have cocktails after that?
Yes, we have a wine reception.
The cocktails are very important. That's the kicker. Our next speaker. When I mentioned our next speaker's name to my boss when I was giving him an update on the progress of setting up these things, he said, "How did you land Rob Casper?" And that is actually a testament to Rob's name in the poetry world, because Rob is not only a poet, but he is programs director at the Poetry Society of America, and they have some tremendous programs as well. And he's a board member of the Council of Literary Magazines and Presses, and also the publisher of the esteemed poetry journal Jubilat, which you see the newest copy is back here. There's another copy in the back to take a look at. So we're really thrilled to have Rob here. So I thank you for making the long, arduous trip from Brooklyn here to be with us. And last but not least, Ed Park is a writer and editor, and Ed is founding editor of the Believer magazine, which you see behind him here. He was also formerly an editor at the Village Voice Literary Supplement. He's been a columnist for everyone from the New York Times, Salon, Boston Globe, the LA Times, and he recently published his first book called Personal Days. There's a copy in the back, which has actually been named as a finalist for the John Sargent Senior First Novel Prize, and also the Penn Hemingway Prize, so that is really terrific. And if you should read it, because it is hilarious. I love this book. It's really funny. So I'm really, really thrilled to have such a great panel. So so what we'll do is we'll start off. Karen, we'll start off, and then we'll take some questions at the end. So enjoy. Thanks.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. I thought Carolyn asked me to begin this, and I thought what I would do is just talk a little bit about my own experience with this collection at the library, and a little history, a little piece about Emily Snell's collection, some of my different experiences there, and then maybe talk about this whole intersection with online and print and some of the issues around that, and I think maybe that's where you guys can jump in. I've been at the library for about 20 years, and when I first landed in the periodicals room about 18 years ago, I was so amazed because the collection there at that point was just in the periodicals room, just amazing stuff, literary, poetry, small press. I mean, basically, back then, and there was money then, so the idea was, the more obscure, the more, limited run, the more we wanted to get a hold of it. So for me, coming out of library school, and this was like my passion, it was just fantastic. And I learned so much, and I got this great experience of building the collection and working with publishers and meeting editors and writers and adding their journals to the collection. The library's collection, it's one of a kind, both historically and currently, of literary magazines. I mean, basically, they've been around since the beginning of the printing press. My sort of knowledge is mostly starts in the mid-19th century with literary magazines and things like The Dial in 1841, edited by Margaret Fuller. We have the small, short run, but we have it. The North American Review, the Yale Review, both starting in the mid-19th century. Still publishing now, two of the longest-running literary magazines. You can see the full runs at the library. And then at the turn of the century with the publication of poetry in 1911, which was another really significant sort of milestone in little magazine publishing, and then on through the 30s and 40s with the Virginia Quarterly Review and all these things now that are still publishing, the library's collection is rich and deep and wonderful. Currently, like Carolyn said, it's around 600 current subscriptions to journals. We are, it's the landscape has changed so much with the whole electronic, the whole internet and electronic, both in terms of how we are researching this material and also how we're building collections of this material. In terms of researching, the library's catalog is online for 20 years. So now when you go into the library catalog, you're searching by title, but you also, if you don't know the title of a literary magazine, you're also using subject headings like modern poetry and these kinds of things, and you need to be able to navigate that, which is, fairly straightforward, but I'm teaching now, actually, classes to my colleagues on doing research, so when people come to the reference desk, they're able to guide people through this. Also, in terms of electronic, if you come to the library, you can use our electronic resources menu, which is a huge array of online sources, databases, and also online journals. And as far as literary magazines go, you will start to find some that are digitized. I can't say it's a whole lot at this point, but things like the Paris Review and the Hudson Review. Hudson Review is completely digitized, so that you can find online. But the Paris Review and other journals, the Kenyon Review, they're starting to digitize gaps of them. So while it's not completely available online, you can get portions of it. Which brings up the issue for us as librarians. When are we going to continuing print subscriptions and then moving to online journals? So maybe that's one of the things that we could talk about. The other piece of the online environment that's so important for all of us is blogs and videos and podcasts and websites and individual journal websites and how we use all of these online sources in the work that we do. So those are some of the things that I'm thinking a lot about these days. And also Carolyn mentioned our programming, the programming piece, Periodically Speaking, which was started in 2005, which was a way to highlight the print collection because I could you could just see the tide was going in this way, and we had this amazing collection and really didn't have sort of, people didn't know that we had it. So we started this media series in 2005 where 6 times a year we bring in editors of literary magazines that introduce emerging writers. So we have three meetings per evening. And it's just been really great because we're getting press and we're on the website, and if you type in a journal like Jubilat, you'll get the New York Public Library also because they participated in Periodically Speaking, which is one of the things that we want to accomplish. We also have an annual event called the Magathon, which is it's May 30th this year, and that's a Saturday afternoon event. And both of these events we co-sponsor with CLMP, by the way, if I didn't say that, the Council of Literary Magazines and Presses, which is fantastic, just been a wonderful collaborator for the library. We started the Magathon with them back in 2001, which is a 3-hour sort of rolling reading, and we have editors come and they just read their favorite sort of 5-minute piece and just get up and just about 30 different people read in like the course of an afternoon, and that has also been really a great it's been a great boom for the library, for the collections, for bringing people in the room. I think that's pretty much my
Maybe I'll talk a little bit about, just briefly say what the Believer is, and then talk about the online issue, which I think is for us it's a pretty vexed question, just as a Believer, as you can see. It's funny that it's here, because I'm a member here, and I would keep going to the Periodicals room and not see the Believer. Kind of sneak some from my private stash. Until I finally subscribe. For those of you that know, the Believer has been around since 2003. We just put out our 60th issue, which I think is on the back table there. It's more or less a monthly. I think we have a couple special double issues, so it's around 10 times a year at this point. And it's an offshoot of McSweeney's, which is a lot of things, but McSweeney's began as pretty much a literary magazine, or a literary quarterly, but I think it's more like maybe twice a year now, or 3 times a year. So McSweeney's, as a publishing institution, already had an outlet for fiction and poetry and kind of unclassifiable things and interesting graphic things. And the idea with the Believer was to put out a more or less a magazine. And it wasn't, and so it's not really a literary journal. We don't publish fiction, even though, recently a wonderful writer, I asked him if he wanted to write something for us, and he sent me something that only sort of halfway through I realized was fiction. And he had kind of, conflated it with McSweeney's, the quarter of the magazine. So the idea was really right from the start to have this publication come out the way a magazine would, the way Harper's or The Atlantic would. Those were maybe sort of our models, maybe a little bit the New York Review of Books. you know, which is of course biweekly. And we were very rigid at first. Like, we thought this is going to be a publication where we talk about books. Books are the most important thing. This 2003, it seemed like in the culture, reviewing was either very short, kind of soundbite reviews, you know, 3 stars, 5 stars, that kind of thing. And at the time, there seemed to be a lot of very kind of long but strangely venomous and almost weirdly irrelevant reviews that took up a lot of space, but kind of seemed to miss the point. Or, you know, we're almost using books as a way to sort of put, you know, bad vibes up. I think the most notorious thing on that end of things was this review of a Rick Moody book calling Rick Moody the worst writer of his generation, which is just so not true in so many ways. And it was this long piece that proceeded to kind of not even talk about Rick Moody, but attack, you know, Joyce and Nabokov and Pynchon. And it made for really kind of interesting reading on one level, but at the end you're kind of like, what was the point of this? So the idea was we would have long pieces, not really reviews per se, but more like literary essays, based on books, some current, some old. In the very first issue, I wrote about the novelist Charles Portis, who hasn't published a novel in years and years, but is someone who I think had not yet received his due. So a mix of these kinds of things. But then it sort of evolved pretty soon after, as we realized we had to do an issue every month. Other things from the culture were talked about, and then to the point where we had a music issue, which actually became our most popular issue. We now have a film issue, we have a visual arts issue. Anyway, I can talk more about that later, perhaps, if people are interested. But I thought I would maybe just touch upon the online component. Nick Sweeney's is famous for just producing these, and I'm kind of talking about them in the third person or something. These beautiful books and these beautiful publications. And I remember going into St. Mark's bookstore, I think this must have been in 98 or so, and just seeing this thing, this white cover with very simple print. And it was the first issue of McSweeney's. I'd never heard it before, but I had to have it. It was just, you know, everything else looked so cluttered and uninteresting by comparison. So I was sort of on board with that aesthetic from the beginning, before I even knew what it was. So when, you know, 5 years later or whatever, in 2003, or actually late 2002, a friend of mine who I knew from grad school wanted to start this magazine for McSweeney's, The Believer. And so, of course, I said yes. And, you know, every time it comes in the mail, every time I get an issue, it's just, I don't really know what the cover's going to look like. I mean, it sort of adheres to this grid, but I don't know what the illustrations are going to look like, the colors, and it just knocks me out the second I open the envelope. I should quickly say McSweeney's is based in San Francisco, so they do all the design and layout and that kind of thing there. Some of the editors are there, myself and Heidi Julewitz, we are both in New York, so we do a lot of our work by email. We don't even call each other. We just email each other, and so we're working on the articles, we're editing them, but we don't know what it looks like. And it's always just, you know, feel free to take a look at that copy. There are several copies behind there. It's just, it's something you want to read because it's so beautiful as sort of this physical thing. I bring this up because the whole idea of how much to offer on the web, I think, is really troubling. As a curious person, somebody who likes to read and learn about things, I want everything on the web. I want to be able to, you know, type in the name of some author who wrote, you know, literary reviews in the 50s and have all his or her reviews available to me. You know, that kind of stuff. And as somebody who sort of writes about these things, that's also kind of, you know, I want that in a way. But to sort of maintain, you know, publish a magazine, if by magazine we're talking about a print object, in 2009, how much are you going to offer online? And if you're going to offer a lot of it, who's going to buy your magazine? And it's not that we pay that much, but it's sort of, if the entire Believer were online, I think we would go under within a couple months. And there would be nothing. There would be no Believer, and we wouldn't do it as an online only thing. I think it's a really difficult question. I'll just say, and I'll stop after this. I'll just say right now we offer one essay a month, and I think one interview a month, and maybe one smaller review or something. And then as time goes on, sometimes we'll put more pieces up online, but it's not a comprehensive thing. So the very first issue of The Believer, you can read the entire thing online. But after that, it's just a couple things per issue, and then we kind of encourage people to order back issues and things like that. But it's something we think about a lot, because it's that we like to think of ourselves as of the moment, and writing about things that are happening in the literary culture and in the broader culture. The way we engage with the online world is almost antiquated. It's like, it's been working for us, but it's still an open niche.
Well, I should say that the reason why The Believer would go under within a couple of months, if it went entirely online, is because of the fact that magazines really only make money on subscription renewals. The magazine sales system is geared towards Time Magazine and U.S. News World Report. They literally, if we send copies of our magazine to Barnes & Noble, when they send them back to us, they tear off the covers. Because, if you have a Time Magazine, you want to tear off the cover because it's no longer timely when you send it back. But obviously, it would be beneficial to us if we got our, copies of Jubilant back with the covers on, because then we could sell them elsewhere in other ways. But that whole system is it's more about marketing. It's more about getting, at least for Jubilant, for The Believer as a monthly, that's probably a little bit different. But for us, that's really about marketing. It's great to get first-time subscriptions, but you do a lot of work as a publisher to get those first-time subscriptions. You offer a lot of discounts. You do things like direct mail and, those goofy letters you get in the mail that want you to subscribe for stuff. When you send out a direct mail like that, the average return rate on that is 1% to 2%. So that means for every 5,000 people you send, you're lucky if you get 50 who sign up. However, the average return rate for a renewal is 75%. So that means once people actually subscribe to literary magazines like ours, they tend to continue to subscribe. You lose one out of every four each year. Strangely enough, there's this system where libraries pay institutional rates for subscriptions, which are usually twice as much as individual rates. I don't know who started that system or why it's there, but it keeps a lot of literary magazines afloat.
And that's actually, one of the things that really worries me about this whole movement to online and the pressure now, honestly, to really look at this and to cancel print subscriptions if it's available electronically. I think magazines that are text-based, that's scientific journals and those kinds of things, scholarly things, maybe it's different than things in the humanities or literary things where you have illustration, you have visuals, you want to hold this thing, you want to look at it, you want to look at the edge, you want to peruse it many times over.
Tactile.
Yeah, exactly. And people come into the library, and that's going to be lost. And also the financial support that these library subscriptions give to the journals.
The temptation for publishers in being online is that you can very easily have as many readers by having an online magazine. Many more readers than the largest literary magazine. There's so many more. It's so much easier to get hits and readers online metadata through the various systems we have. We publish 2,000 copies of our issue twice a year. And we figure our circulation is, you know, we don't sell them all, but it's, you know, like 1,600, 1,700. But, I mean, we just got statistics on the number of hits on our website, and it's, you know, per year, like 30,000 or something like that. So, and I mean, Poetry Magazine is the largest poetry magazine in the country, the big, and they have about 20,000 subscribers, I believe. So, you think about that. And it's very cheap, you know. What's interesting, too, is that technology has changed a lot for publishers. It's cheaper to publish, actually publish a print magazine than it used to be. Once upon a time, you'd have to get, what's the word? Before the advent of desktop publishing, you had...
Mechanicals?
No, you'd get the mechanicals. You'd have typesetting. You'd have someone do the typesetting for you. And now... which would involve the mechanicals. And now, you know, you can do all of that online. When we started Jubilock in 2000, we just had someone, the person who had done the template for Plowshares did the template for Jubilock, and we've stuck with it ever since. We paid him like $750, and that was that. So, whereas I know the Massachusetts Review, where I once interned, they spent something like $20,000 a year on typesetting, you know, to come out 3 or 4 times a year. So that's changed a lot. But the thing about online journals is that it costs practically nothing to do. I mean, you don't have to print. You know, if you have someone who's on the staff or the editor who's proficient in web design, then you're all set. But you do, yeah, you lose something. And to talk about that, I'll back up a little bit to sort of explain about Jubilock, which I started back in 2000 with some graduate students at the graduate program that I was in, the MFA graduate program. It's housed at this program at the University of Massachusetts. We started with the idea that we wanted a small little magazine. We were interested in the number of poets who were being published, but we decided that instead of sort of announcing a new group of poets, as a magazine called Fence had done a year or two before we started, and we sort of shared a lot of their poets, we decided instead that we wanted to connect poetry to the world in interesting ways. So we have in Jubilock, we have often strange reprints or found pieces. We do interviews with poets, but sometimes not poets. This issue, the latest issue, has an interview with a rogue perfumist. You know, because we realize that when you read poetry, too often poetry, people talk about poetry as like this sort of rarefied and kind of isolated thing, you know. But you read poetry, and then you go out and experience the world. You know, you read poetry, and you look at your window, and you see neighbors, or you hear music, or... And poetry, I think, is more vital for its connection to the world than it is for what it does for you on its own in its little rarefied space of the page. So many magazines do the kind of reprints and fun things we do. What differentiates us is we do it in a poetry magazine, and we don't draw any distinction. There's not a separate section, a reprint section. So if you flip through the pages, you're just as likely to find a poem written by someone who's very young as you are, you know, a little found piece by the poet John Clare on Birds of Northamptonshire, or you know, a list of the wrestling archive of crazy wrestling movies, or what have you. So it's more about that kind of discovery and connection. What's interesting to me, now putting on my hat as a person, I worked at the Council of Literary Magazines and Presses as the membership director for 7 years, and I'm on the board as a magazine person, but what's interesting to me in that capacity is the fact that the literary culture is so vital, and that in the past 10, 15 years, a lot of literary magazines have come out. And I mean, you look at The Believer and you look at Jubilock, and they're serving two very, very different functions and kind of operating in different ways. I mean, we come out twice a year. Like I said, our print run is 2,000. I'll bet you The Believer's is 3 or 4 times that.
About, yeah,
coming out monthly. But that's sort of what's exciting about what's happening with magazines right now is that I feel like it's a very lively time. At the Council of Literary Magazines and Presses, when I started, we had 280 members, and now they have over 500. And in part, that was 8-9 years ago. That's a reflection on, I think, just the energy of Lit Mags at the moment. And a whole bunch came out, in the past 10, 15 years.
And people always ask that, are these things still publishing, or is online, taking over? And it's so not true, so not true from, all the new things that I'm buying and adding.
Karen, first you would, I'd like to hear from everybody. Does the New York Public Library have a strategy that involves publishing on things, handhelds like Kindle and the others?
A strategy? No, I mean, I'm not sure what.
Well, if you can download, one of the issues with long online is you can't walk around with it, but if now you
right.
can download it to something that you can hold in your hand like a book, does that change the strategy that the magazines are going to take? And if so or if not, how does it impact libraries? In the same way that a library pays more for a subscription to a print magazine,
mm-hmm.
would they perhaps, I'm just
right.
wondering, but would they perhaps pay more to get a Kindle version that they can then give to download to to their membership at an even lesser
yeah.
price? I don't know.
It's certainly possible, because in terms of like books now, you can download electronic books from the library's website for free. You can download it if you go to the library's website. So that would be, presumably then you're saying,
download
we make
to what?
To your if you have a Kindle or if you have,
Let me just jump in too and say that I think devices like the Kindle are more impactful to presses
mm.
than magazines.
Mm.
I think that if I owned a Kindle, what I would want is the kind of book that I wouldn't care to own, the kind of book that you read, and it's interesting and exciting, but it's of that moment.
Mm-hmm.
I think nothing, even if you can get all the, find out every magazine too that's in the New York Public Library, and get all that content, it doesn't replace the actual experience of going into that physical space and being able to look around. You know, that what libraries do and what bookstores do is, as well as kind of offer a curatorial selection and give you the opportunity to browse in a way that it's harder to do. The way in which you connect online, I think, is, you type in a Google search and you find all sorts of connections. The way if you go to a bookstore or a magazine store or a library that you find out about things is it's right there, and you say, oh, okay, I'll pick this up and look at this too. You don't necessarily know what you're looking for in a certain way.
Serendipity.
Yeah, there's a certain serendipity to Google too,
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've all had that moment, I'm sure, of like, suddenly realizing you spent an hour searching around and you started wanting to learn about, a certain poet, and you've ended up, reading about whatever. When we designed Jubilant, we designed it to be sort of purposely small. It visually looks sort of like what it is, as opposed to the Believer. The Believer says, we have a lot of articles, we're very dynamic and fun and playful, but it looks more like it's sort of moving into the space of like a monthly
yeah.
magazine. We designed this so that it almost fit into your back pocket. And we sort of picked a very kind of clean, but kind of slightly fun little font. But we wanted it to whatever degree feel like an object. And I think what will happen, my guess, my best guess, people want to know what that about what will happen with Kindle type objects is that it will make people will print less bestsellers. you know, the kind of books you read, or, you know, summer reads, like the kind of books, yeah, that you don't want to be able to reach. I mean, I feel even looking at my own library, like, mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to not have all those books there to look at, you
right.
know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that will be very useful. But I don't think it will replace, in fact, it will make the physical experience of the library more important, because that's really what it will offer that otherwise you won't get elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Refine it.
It'll become more of its own special option, mm-hmm. you know.
That's a great question. I think you said Believer doesn't publish fiction.
No, it doesn't. Yeah.
And I've looked through other literary magazines. You go through the table of contents, and there are reviews, there are literary articles, most of them pretty boring. But maybe one story in a literary magazine, or possibly two. Pieces of fiction. Why publish a literary magazine without publishing fiction?
Well, in the case of The Believer, there's already, McSweeney's already has a whole separate publication that does fiction, poetry, mm-hmm. and, you know, has become sort of, I mean, for better or worse, I think for better, but, you know, there's a particular kind of fiction that people think of as McSweeney's fiction. Like, it's stuff that's often formally playful. I think when it first started, you know, this is back in the late 90s, kind of a lot of authors people were not so familiar with, or writers who still hadn't, you know, achieved the thing that they have now. You know, just off the top of my head, people like Jonathan Lethem, who are now, you know, quite big and well-known, a lot of them had maybe published books before McSweeney's, but sort of got folded into that, Zadie Smith to an extent, things like that. So for us, McSweeney's does that, and it does it, you know, really, really well. There was no reason for The Believer, which is, we actually now publish one poem an issue, but, you know, we're primarily like a nonfiction
yep.
magazine.
But I was talking about these other literary magazines too, that we might have published one story per issue.
Well, I think they've actually published more than that.
Juliet
is primarily.
Oh, I know. We're going through these tables of contents,
yeah.
and it's all reviews, articles, one story, maybe two stories. I mean,
it depends. I mean, there are definitely journals.
It depends on the magazine. I mean,
there's very little outlet for fiction, for short stories.
I'm sure you would say the same thing. I would disagree. I would just say there are a lot of magazines. I mean, there are a number of magazines that like Fiction Magazine and Other Voices. Or one story, which sends out one story in a little pamphlet to only to subscribers six times a year.
Yeah.
Six, eight times a year. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of magazines that are more geared towards fiction than nonfiction or poetry. You know, with over 600 titles, 600 magazines, literary magazines at the New York Public Library, it gives you a sense of the sort of variety of the field. And in fact, we used to say at CMMP that at any given point in time, there's almost 1,000 literary magazines, but many of them, you know, have one issue, or they're just focused on their community, you know, never even reach Karen, who is more than anyone I know trying very, very hard to find out about every magazine in the country. But I would say to you, if that's how you feel, you know, go to the periodical section of the New York Public Library and look around, because I bet you find a lot of magazines that are more focused on fiction than you know, nonfiction, certainly poetry too.
This is a question for Rob and Ed. Do you largely commission work, or do you take pitches? And if so, you know, what do you look for, and you know, how do you find your writers?
It's probably a little different for us. Complicated. We definitely, especially, you know, now that we've been around for a while, there are writers we've used who, you know, who kind of are in tune with the magazine, or, you know, I know a writer like, I'm just thinking of what I'm working on now, a writer named Paul Lafarge, who's written stuff right from the very first issue, and he just has a sensibility that I like, and he's interested in interesting things that we think our readers will like. So if he were to come to me and say, I want to write about such and such, chances are I would say, that sounds great, you should do it. And I'll also go to him if I hear of a book or something that I thought that I think he might want to pursue. So there are a number of writers like that. I mean, sort of like a stable of writers, perhaps. But you know, we barely pay anything, so it's like a labor of love on everyone's part. We do have I guess on the website, you know, there's a submissions thing, and people are always sending pitches, which some of which get to me or my co-editors, Heidi and Daniela. Others of which sort of, you know, we have a managing editor who also fields those and sort of greenlights stuff if it does seem interesting. But then, you know, there's a lot of stuff coming in, so I guess what I hope this is also answering your question. What we're looking for when it comes to pitches is whether the person knows what the believer is. Because I think it's probably different with something focusing on poetry, but with nonfiction, you often get the kind of thing where an article has been killed by every other magazine in town and you're like, produce an article. And it's, you know, and it might be great for New York Magazine or a glossier magazine, but it's completely, I know it from like the first paragraph. Like if it's, I meet so-and-so at a cafe in the meatpacking district, you know, it's like this kind of interviewees, which I like reading when I pick up, a certain kind of magazine, but it's just not gonna fit in The Believer. There's also like issues of timeliness, you know, we have like a long lead time, so we don't really do like breaking news so much. And you know, those articles that have kind of, you know, been around the block in a way, they usually kind of age badly. So it's really, the writer has to sort of, you can often tell just also from the pitch letter, like, that they've read The Believer and know the kinds of things we do. And, you know, we like to keep an open mind and we don't want to be, you know, I think at first we were quite rigid, or I was quite rigid. It was like 4,000 word articles on books, and no quotes, you know, no interview quotes, like all these things. And we kind of loosened that up a little, and we've, you know, and it's made the magazine better. But I also think it's kind of one of those things where a writer who's going to pitch should know, I mean, not just for The Believer, but for any magazine he or she wants to write for, kind of know what the venue is. Yeah,
get a lot of questions? Of 100 pitches that come through your door, what percentage of them are even vaguely give you the feeling that the person knows who they're pitching? Like how bad is the hit ratio of what people are tossing at you?
Well, let's see. I don't know if I would put a number on it. And like I said, there are sort of other levels, like Wizard of Oz. Like there are people before me.
But I'll let Ed answer the question before I do my little number spiel.
Okay. I have to say, like, I'm just mentally kind of thinking of all the pitches I got in the last, you know, in the last couple of weeks. Let's say I get one every 2 days. Okay, so out of 20 pitches, maybe I'd say about a quarter of them are interesting. The subject matter is interesting, and then out of those, you know, does the writer's sensibility kind of align, you know, with the readers? It's also hard because sometimes it's, you know, these are new writers and you don't really know what their writing is like. And they'll send you some clips, but it's like they're only able to write these small things that maybe don't represent what they can do in a longer form. So, and I hate doing this, but I'll sometimes say, if you'd like to write it on spec, then we'll, you know, which means I'm not going to guarantee the meager payment that we give, but you know, we will take a look, and you know, we don't want to shut the door, because you know, what if the person writes this great thing and then it would be great.
I'll just say, and then I'll get back to your question about solicitation too. Of the pieces that we get, like 5,000 or 6,000 submissions a year, and we publish two issues with about 30 writers each. Of the work that we receive, 90% of it is not relevant to us. It's not at the kind of level we're looking for. It's clear that the people who are sending to us are just sending to us because we're another magazine, haven't read us, haven't thought about us, are not connected to poetry in the way that we're connected. you know, don't understand the community that we're creating with each magazine. And then there's the other 10%, and then of that 10%, there's work. And then the work, that 90% is, it gets rejected very quickly, but sometimes it frustrates me, because I'm like, you know, read the magazine, get a sense of it, have a sense of what you're writing yourself, and how it might or might not fit in. Then there's the 10% that we're sort of considering, and of that 10%, I think that 5% of that is the easy stuff to reject, because it's clearly not for Jubilant. It could be for another magazine, kind of at the level we're at, but not the kind of writing that we're looking for. You know, it's kind of the kind of writing that would be better at the New England Review or the Virginia Quarterly Review or wherever, Poetry Magazine, even places that are more esteemed and established than ours, but just isn't right for the kind of mix of what we're looking for, the kind of things that we publish. And so we're really only considering 5% of what we receive. I think we have a 2 to 3% acceptance rate, and that's actually fairly high compared to the most established literary magazines, which are usually under 1%. And what that means for you, if you're writing and sending out to these magazines, is that you really have to know what you're doing, because otherwise you stand a real shot. You're probably, likely, not going to get accepted. Yeah.
Sorry, I just was going to say, because so many, maybe you have this, Carolyn, here, but you know, at the library, so many writers come to use this collection, mm-hmm. and they are just, you know, looking at like 20, you know, just writing out the slips, perusing, you know, but you just make me think about, you know, that could be helpful for me working with people that come in to kind of understand this idea that,
yeah.
you know, you maybe want to look at fewer and sort of have a better sense.
I would
about
just
what the journal's about, rather than
yeah.
they do publish poetry,
yeah.
they do
yeah.
publish
yeah.
short stories,
exactly.
they do nonfiction.
Let me just jump back to what Ed said for just a quick second, though. In terms of solicitation, in the beginning, we solicited a lot of people early on because no one knew who we were. But the goal of every magazine is, I'm sure The Believer, it's the same with The Believer, too. I don't know if you were the first, I doubt you were the first magazine to publish Paul Lafarge, but you want to be a magazine where people are, where you get to publish writers that get to be identified as Jubilant writers and Believer writers. And those people are not the John Ashbery's of the world, who, you know, John Ashbery is my favorite poet, and I was thrilled to publish him and interview him, but, you know, it was kind of anticlimactic when I did, because it felt like everyone's published John Ashbery, you know, it's my turn to publish him like everybody else. And whereas we have a poet, Srikant Reddy, we published his first poem, and then he had a book out, and he teaches now, and he's doing well, and so sometimes it seems like literary magazines, you know, are only publishing their friends, or, you know, famous people, and I think good literary magazines create their own writers, and you may be one of those writers too, who are all looking for the next writer who we can say we got them first. Mm-hmm. So
maybe I'll just, because I just noticed this is not the current issue but one issue back, there's an article here by a guy named Theo Shell Lambert. He wanted to write about a book that he read in this prep school he went to, I think somewhere in Philadelphia, and you know, I said, sure, you know, write it. And he wrote this thing, and it was sort of, it was just dwelling too much on kind of these gauzy memories of prep school days and this one kind of interesting teacher that he had there who made him read a book called Let's Kill Uncle, which I actually found, they have it here at the library. And it's a great Edward Gorey cover, if you can see it. But this was a while ago, and it's like, Theo, you know, it's you're just talking too much about yourself. I want to. What's the real story behind it? So, the author of the book is she wrote it under the name Rowan O'Grady, but her real name is June Skinner, and she lives in Vancouver, and no one's heard anything from her for years. And at some point, like while these months go by, and he's thinking about this book and what it means to him. He's like, well, is she still alive? What's she doing? And so it becomes that the article suddenly became mm-hmm. transformed into this thing where he kind of sent a few emails, and like her son-in-law had an email address, and he went there and he met her, and it's one of my, it's really one of my favorite things that we published. And he's, I think sort of what Rob's saying, he, you know, Theo's sort of, he's written for some other places, but this is really like, I think this piece is as good as something you'd read in the New Yorker. But it's but on the other hand, I don't know if I could see it in the New Yorker. Like, if there's something about it that to me is like ineffably believery, and you know, it. But it was also, I guess I also want to emphasize that it was this process that he felt strongly about this idea. It wasn't quite right. Over a year of him thinking, and sometimes the good articles, it's not that you know immediately what you have to do, but you have to kind of live with it. And I don't know, it's the kind of thing that for me makes publishing editing The Believer worthwhile. You get the excitement of a writer figuring out what the story is that he or she wants to tell. And so I'd recommend this article particularly.
In terms of fiction, short stories, and these literary magazines, it is not possible to read the current 600 magazines to figure out where you might work.
Right.
And you need help to narrow that in. Mm-hmm. So what would you recommend to a short story writer,
mm-hmm,
in terms of getting a much more narrow focus for the reading? Every editor I've ever spoken to or heard talk said you have to know the magazine, I get that,
mm-hmm,
but there's a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And editors change, and
right,
trends change, and
mm-hmm,
so how on earth can you narrow that channel?
You want me to take that question?
You take it.
Easy. You look at the, if you're looking at short stories or poems, it's easier than fiction. You look at their table of contents and see where they published. The writers that you love. You know, you take all their books and you look at all those magazines. And you also have a fair assessment of the kind of writing you do. Not only the writers that you love, but writers that you love that you feel like your work is in connection with aesthetically somehow. Because you really, it's about, finding the right community for you, finding the right editor for you, finding the right people published. If that makes sense. So novels, it's tougher, but you wouldn't be looking to magazines for novels anyway.
Right.
So, you had a question in the back? Yeah.
Yes, I did. I was wondering if you could quantify meager and almost nothing.
Yes, I can quantify. I can. We started out paying for an article of 4,000 words, $500, which is not really that much, but. Yeah, it's not interesting. Now we pay, I think, around $300.
As you become more successful, you.
Well, we don't. Well, that's the thing. We're not becoming more successful. People know who we are, and I think there is a readership. But it's. I think we also have a flawed business model. We're very dependent on subscriptions, and one of the things I was talking about being rigid before, we didn't want to have advertisements in the issue for various reasons. In the last year or so, we do, I think, a one-page ad or something. I don't even think advertisements would solve the problem. It's an ongoing problem, kind of trying to finance it, and it's. I think some people have the illusion that McSweeney's is like this thing that has bottomless money, but that's completely not the case. And I don't get paid. I got paid a little bit at the beginning, and then we're like, okay, the editors can't get paid. So it's really we're doing it because we
love
it. It's a cliche, but it really, if I didn't get excited by an article, the article I was just telling you about, I wouldn't do it. It wouldn't be worth it. But I do think we're bringing something to the literary culture that I don't think it's not there. You can't really find it in any other way. So
thank you.
That's why. It's
I'll tell you a funny story. My family had a birdseed company, KT Birdseed. I think you can find it in stores here, and they sold the company. And I got a little bit of money from that, and that's how I started Jubilana. And it was the most anti-capitalist thing I could possibly do, because magazines always lose money, literary magazines. I can tell you, working at La Casa Literary Magazines and Presses, poets too. Poets usually report a loss in terms of income, but there's something great about that. There's something beautiful about that. I don't get paid either, I know. many of you who read poetry might know Copper Canyon Press, which is one of the nation's best literary, independent literary publishers. The editors of that press, which is, you know, as successful as an independent literary press can get, didn't pay themselves for like 20 years, which is crazy. But it's sort of how it works. I mean, we pay, and you know, on the opposite end, we pay submitters, contributors, $20. Is it $20? $20 for one poem, and $40 for two more poems or piece, prose piece. I mean, it's sort of ridiculous. But it's less ridiculous when you think about the fact that we're not getting paid at all. So it's sort of that's one of the great joys of the literary world is the degree to which it's built on a kind of creating a community which supersedes all the ways in which, you know, people go around actually putting food on their table.
Do you think that will make you immune to what's happening with the economy now, or does that mean that a lot of?
Well, I think definitely. I think that the way in which it affects literary magazines is in a downturn of subscriptions, loss of funding, and loss of continuing support to people who give money to the magazine, you know, above and beyond their subscriptions. But I also like to think of the metaphor I use for literary magazines or literature is that, you know, we're in a big ocean of commerce, and there's a tidal wave or a hurricane above, and you know, we exist down there where there's no light even. You know, so you know, that's all going on overhead and we don't totally feel it. I think it will dramatically change what happens with literary fiction. And I think hopefully for the better. The poetry model is a better model for writers, I think for reading public, which is independent literary presses, like Copper Canyon at the top, and Grey Wolf Press, and New Directions, and then sort of on down, publish 90%, over 90% of all poetry in this country. And but they do a better job of supporting those writers. It's a little bit like baseball. You know, baseball, you have to go to the minor leagues, and you sort of prove yourself in the minor leagues. And there, those publishers are in the minor leagues in terms of money, more than in terms of the work they published. You know, it was great work, but in terms of you know, building writers who can, you know, poets who can sell 20,000 copies or 30,000 copies, which for a poet is a heck of a lot. They do a good job of starting somebody like a Billy Collins, for instance, starting somebody out small. He was at the University of Pittsburgh Press for a long time, and then he moved up to a major publishing house. And it's very community-based, the poetry world. You know, people know each other, and there are a lot of readings across the country, and people meet each other. Fiction, there's still a belief among the sort of big fiction houses and the publishers of fiction houses that they can find the next great writer. You know, publish that next great writer's first novel. And so it happens often in fiction houses. In some ways, literary fiction is in its death throes, I think, in the big fiction houses, in the old way, in the sense that major publishers are still throwing huge advances at young writers and having these crazy bidding wars. But what happens is many of the writers who get those big advances, I don't know what you got
I'm sure you're young.
Well, but you're better off not being a young writer in that way, because often, I mean, every once in a while, even someone who gets a big advance will become a big famous writer with their first book, and their second book will do better, and their third book will do better. But it puts tremendous economic pressure on that writer, and if they don't do it, they're screwed. I mean, it's really difficult. If you get $100,000 in advance for two books, and your first book sells even a decent, like 5,000 copies. I had a friend, you know, short story writer, who, that's what happened to him. He got, you know, then he had a lot of pressure on his novel to sell, and it didn't sell very well. And, you know, luckily his publisher stayed with him, but that's not going to continue to happen because they can't afford to do that. So hopefully literary fiction will be more supported by independent presses, and they can build up, writers can build up readerships so that when they move to a big publishing house, they can do so with more certainty that the money that those publishers are putting into them can will work out.
Just to get back to literary magazines instead of the publishing houses.
Yeah.
so many of the really well-established and long-lived magazines are academic, come from academic institutions. And to follow up on this question about the economy, the scholastic institutions are in deep trouble in terms of endowment, in terms of funding, closing all kinds of things, including their art museums. And I wonder if you have any take on what will happen to those academic literary magazines.
I'm an academic. I don't want to keep on talking, but you know. In Jubilat's case, we're so small we don't even count in terms of the budget. I mean, we don't cost the university that much. A lot of the larger literary magazines have ways to get money, have ways to reach out to an audience beyond that particular university. So they bring in income. It's rare that a literary magazine is entirely supported by its university. And in fact, what was interesting to me at CLMP to learn was I assumed all academic literary magazines had a lot of support, you know, from their university. They were paying for a bunch of things. They were paying salaries for managing editors and stuff like that, and that's actually quite rare. So I think the very little bit that the University of Massachusetts gives us for Jubilat, you know, isn't worth them cutting out, considering that we are a marketing arm for them. You know, we get out there, we get pieces in Harper's, and we were on NPR. And I think if you succeed in that way as a literary magazine, it's more like you're almost like the alumni magazine, you know. And at a much more reduced cost. So, but it'll happen probably to some of the larger ones that are more strongly supported by their universities. I remember Shenandoah, for instance, which is a very old and established literary magazine, had a tough time maybe 5 years ago with its administration and had to do a lot of work. CLMP helped them out. And they're published by the Cowan Washington and Lee University in Virginia. CLMP helped them kind of substantiate, legitimize why they were doing what they were doing and how important they were to the university. But they probably cost the university a lot more money. They have full-time staff in a way that Jubilat doesn't. So, deans and provosts will start looking at those kinds of magazines, I think, as they try to cut money. So it's possible. But less likely, again, than in other parts of our life.
Is there a place for memoir in these magazines? Like a piece that might not be book length, but would be fairly long?
I'm trying to think of offhand. I mean, with The Believer, we sometimes do, this is actually a new development, we sometimes will have what we kind of think about as first person accounts that aren't necessarily connected to a literary thing. So I think last November, October, we ran a piece about a writer of ours who had done many pieces for us, but always sort of based on books, but about his failed bid to run for a seat in the House of Delegates in Maryland. But it was kind of this, you know, it wasn't going to be a full-length, you know, a book-length memoir, but it was just kind of this great sort of snapshot of, you know, this moment in his life. We don't do it that much. We don't do it, definitely not in every issue, but occasionally we do. I'm trying to think of other literary magazines or literary journals that do emphasize memoir.
I don't know. I can't think of one that emphasizes it, but I can say that I think a lot of them do publish it, because I know with Periodically Speaking, we've had
several that have read memoir pieces. I know, like, one was the Hudson Review. It was published in the Hudson Review, and I think Creative Nonfiction. Those are the only two I can think of off the top of my head, but
Raritan.
There's been Raritan.
Yeah, could you search for memoirs and magazines through the library? Find out which magazines have memoirs.
No, but actually, When Carolyn was my intern at the library, she worked on a project, which is a directory of the literary magazine collection. And one of the things that we worked on together was establishing how we're going to search this directory.
Yeah.
So you could search for a short story, poem, essay.
Yes.
What else?
General nonfiction. Yeah, we had split it out precisely because the cataloging records were not as descriptive as we would have liked. There wasn't really a way to find literary magazines or little magazines and presses in one fell swoop to look, you know, in the catalog. You'd have to know what you were looking for, and that's kind of frustrating. So we had gone through each one of them and then kind of identified, either by looking at the magazine or by looking on CLMP's site or New Pages, some of these other sites, to see what they published. Because most of these, and that's a good place to start, I would say, is the CLMP site or New Pages, which the websites are listed in this handout, because you can look through various magazines very quickly and go to, and if they have a website, you can go directly to their website. And almost every one of them has a website, has a submissions link that tells you how to submit and what they're accepting, so that you don't waste, you know, don't waste your time. I mean, if they don't accept something that you're working on, then it's not for you. I mean, they're very, most of them are very specific in telling you, you know, what kinds of work that they accept and how they accept it and when their reading periods are and all kinds of stuff. There's a wealth of information on that site. I mean, it's great. And you know, you can't search, unfortunately, the way you're trying to do it. And I don't know how, whatever, I mean, I hate to put you on the spot and find out whatever happened with that.
My directory?
That database.
Oh,
yeah.
It's with our digital people.
But that was the idea, so that you could search, you know, in the for the literary magazines and small presses by a specific type, you know, poetry, short story, nonfiction. I don't think memoir was a category, but I don't think it was large enough to really.
Yeah.
And we kind of based it on what the magazines themselves indicated their primary focus was. So that's kind of where we gathered those categories from.
I think the CLMP directory, which is now being republished again by Right Hand Press, I think it breaks down
memoir.
It has categories in the back, so you should check that out. It's a print. You know, they have it online. We're checking out. The literary press and magazine directory.
We have it downstairs.
Okay. You can check it out, and
yeah.
I think it has something in the back. But I also wanted to get back to an earlier question. You asked a woman in turquoise about sort of finding things more specifically. I think the internet is very useful in that sense too, because you know, you can go quickly through website pages.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a little slow.
You can go more quickly than sort of perusing magazines, you know, even at a place like the periodicals room at the New York Public Library. And I think that's just in terms of like a quick glance at a lot of different magazines. Yeah, and there are places like Plashwist has a really good list of literary magazines. The CLMP website I think does too. I don't know. There are other places. Are there other resources you use online to find out?
Yeah, I put that purple handout. There's a whole bunch of websites that I listed that are kind of the places that I go for exactly the kind of thing you're talking about. Even like Poetry Foundation.
Yeah.
I mean, Academy of American Poets. All of these sites, you can find, you know, really great lists, all kinds of great information about modern magazines.
Would anybody know if there's more opening, perhaps in British publications for American writers rather than agonistic scene?
I know that there are connections between British and American poets. There's an essay that came out by a now well-known critic, Stephen Burt, in a number of years back, in Poetry Review, Poetry Review, I think it is, which is the big publication, big British publication, on the new style of poetry, which happened to have a lot of impact on American poets, but it first came out in England. I think there's more interplay, and there are a lot of British poets and poets from the United Kingdom who are here or come here a lot. People like Ron Boland and Paul Muldoon, who are Irish. Andrew Motion, I know, it comes here every once in a while. So I think there's a growing connection. I don't know if, I think if you're an American writer, there's so many places in America to get published. You could get published in a British magazine, but it doesn't necessarily, there's sort of no reason to, at least I think.
I was wondering about the believer on your flawed business model. Do you think that there's hope of surviving? What do you see as the future of the believer? I mean, I was curious
the future
until you
is when
find
I start
that
paying
out
money
with surviving so far.
Yeah, I don't know. We've thought about things, and we've kind of looked into whether not going nonprofit was an option, but that's kind of is very. I don't even understand it. I think I signed something. I don't think we're going to do. Like, I kind of feel like that's not going to happen either. I don't know. We'll just, in some ways, I'm a little bit, you know, because I'm not the publisher, and I don't, you know, I sit here in New York, and I edit the pieces, and I'm a little bit protected from that. But anytime they do show me the numbers, it's sort of like, oh. I mean, the number, you know, people are reading it, and you know, our, I think back there, I have a copy of one of our music issues. These things sell really well, but you know, how do you, what's the next step? I don't know, like, realistically, how many subscribers can we expect? And it's, you know, but it's worked for 5 years, you know, and you know, I'm happy with what we've done. Yeah, it would be, obviously it would be sad if we had to close our doors, but it won't happen. That's a big answer.
How many subscribers do you have?
How many subscribers do we have? I don't know. I know that something like a music issue combined subscription and bookstore, something like 12, I think over 12,000. But, you know, a lot of that is people want that particular issue. So not all, and it was somehow weirdly hard to break down how much of that was our circulation. Our circulation is probably closer to, like, for the regular issues, probably closer to 8,000, maybe a little higher. It's been at least a year and a half since I saw the numbers, but, you know, and we keep trying to promote it, and you know, people do read it, but, you know, at this point, we're just kind of, it's like issue by issue, yeah.
Is there any such thing as, literature being published online without a print equivalent? I mean, has anybody found a way to make that work?
There are many, many magazines that do that.
To make it work financially or just make it work?
Well, make it work financially. Well,
yeah.
Basically, and I mean, like they expect people to just print out what they offer. Or
read it online.
Yeah.
I think it's worked better for poetry magazines, and it's had more acceptance in poetry magazines. I don't think Best American Stories accepts online publications, but certainly for many years, Best American Poetry has.
Is this a trend?
It was a few years ago. I don't know if it is to the same degree. What's interesting about the trend, when I started working at CMMP, it was 2001, and we opened up our doors to online publishers, and very quickly got about 50 or 60 of them. But what's happened now, and you can you know, tell me if you agree with this,
mm-hmm.
Karen, is that online publishers are publishing print anthologies, or print magazines are sort of turning to online. There's sort of an interesting blurring of boundaries between the two. In the beginning, it was like, we're the online publishers, this is what we do. And it seems in the last couple of years that's changed.
I think that's true. And we haven't even, you know, at the library, haven't even quite dealt with how we're going to deal with these online journals. You know, we're still focused on collecting print,
mm-hmm.
and the two, you know, the websites and the, you know, what print journals offer in terms of their website. And is it this, you know, we haven't even, like, gotten to, you know, e-journals, electronic journals.
Right.
mean, it's so overwhelming.
There's so much.
Oh, I know. Oh, and are there more online journals than print?
No, I wouldn't argue. I would say that probably not. But who knows what's going to happen? And now, but if you take into account how many magazines like Jubilant, which is primarily a print magazine, has an online presence, practically everybody is online.
Everybody has a website.
Everybody has probably most people have some sort of content.
Publish something.
Yeah. It's very rare that they just have a website. You know, saying, I am Jubilant.
Subscribe to me.
You know what I mean? And I think magazines. I mean, we're right now going through a web redesign. We're applied to NEA for web redesign and thinking about adding more content. For many years, we just have like the Believer, you know, sort of one, like a little teaser piece.
Teaser.
Exactly. To be like, you know, you like this, you know, now
yeah.
please. And we realize that I still want to primarily have a magazine be something that people read, you know. Mm-hmm. But there are other things you can do, like Karen said. I mean, we can put audio, we can have video, we can link. There's all sorts of ways that you can connect. You can sort of harness the power of the internet effectively. So it is, yeah.
I teach at a couple places, and some of my students they want to start magazines, and I'm always like, oh, so you should do it online, but they don't want to do it online.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. I mean, they'll have a website with just like little teasers,
mm-hmm.
but. And what can I say? I'm like, well, good luck. But they are not. They don't feel the same. I don't know what it is. They don't feel the same passion. Like, still online is slightly
mm-hmm.
not legitimate for them. Which I'm actually over that. I've published stuff in online only forums, I think it's fine. I think in a way that's what's going to happen. There's also certain things where I was just reading something where. It's not that you read it online, but it's a PDF that you can then
mm-hmm.
print out. So it's kind of a in between. But it was really curious because this is just in the last, you know, couple months. A couple grad students at Columbia putting out a magazine called Gigantic, and it's going to be like printed on newsprint that you fold up.
Mm-hmm.
So they're keeping the cost down, but getting a lot of content in there and very minimal website. And then another student wants to start this magazine that's going to be like nothing else, and I'm, you know, urging him to, you know, at least have a website.
I've thought a lot about the difference in the experience.
Yeah.
I mean, the sheer pleasure of touching the printed page and the hands turning the page and the weight of the book or the literary journal, that there are senses that are involved and tactile, and you know, many things are going on, and it's different. There is a removal. I mean, you can be reading on a screen, but something is missing. Ooh. You know, and I think it follows through with all of our lives today. We experience in such a different way. It's almost cut off from the real experience
yeah.
of being a human being and engaging.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's a primal thing.
The human animal in,
mm-hmm.
in
yeah.
that experience, the intellectual, the emotional. But it doesn't seem incomplete.
I read that somebody wants to get some kind of spray for the Kindle, and if it's
small, yeah, nothing. I don't think anything will replace actual books. I don't think people will read entirely online. And I think what I've come to realize is that the best way to live is to, and the way to publish for me is to have both. Is to not. I mean, I privilege one over the other. I always privilege the actual book, but I don't want. I'm no longer interested in the idea that the website is merely an advertiser for that experience.
Right.
I want them to be some kind of dialogue because,
mm-hmm.
you know, I also read things online and I read books too. And just as I was talking about poetry sort of being connected to the world, it's nice to think that those two experiences, the experience of picking up a book and reading and the experience of, you know, looking at something online, those two can be interrelated in a sort of,
mm-hmm.
in a sort of dynamic way as opposed to being very, very separate things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They're just
mm-hmm.
both part of our lives.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Do you want some water?
I do want some.
I'm desperately thirsty. Thanks. Yeah, it's a lunchbox that we put this image on top of. Yeah, I haven't been happy with the last couple, so no, I'm happier with this one. We've had problems with our printer, so we with this issue, which came out way too late because we spent 3 months dealing with the printer, we moved with it to a different printer. That was much better.
Thanks so much. Thank you. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks
so much.
Which printer do you use?
We moved to, we were with Cushing Malloy, and now we're back to West Canada.
West Canada.
Yeah, West Canada's a lot better.
Can I ask one question?
Yeah.
You talked about the author, the critic,
Stephen Burke.
B-U-R-T.
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 He has a book that just came out.
When was the essay published?
It was published in Poetry Review, British magazine, but it's in, he has a book of essays, and that essay begins. Actually, what's interesting is in that book of essays, that essay begins the book, and Stephen had a kind of later essay that was published in The Believer that ends the book. And in between, he sort of talks about individual poets. So, and I forget what the name of the book is, but you can Google it, you know. But a Poetry Review, there's a Poetry Society in England, that's sort of like the famous Poetry Society. A Poetry Review, I didn't find it safe, but if I don't have the town for it, it's like, you have to be famous. Anyway.
Okay, great, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Terrific, thank you for coming.
You must have Jeff
Lexer. I do
have Jeff Lexer. Yeah, of course.
He has a lot of
where you